Hello, you are listening to the Plumfield Moms, and this is Our Reading Life in partnership with our friends from BiblioGuides.
Hi, I'm Diane Pendergraft, and I'm here with Sarah Masaryk, and we are with Sarah Kim and Tanya Arnold again today to talk about books.
You know, I am particularly grateful that we have this appointment every month because all four of us are in incredibly busy seasons, and we have had very little time to connect in any other capacity. And I'm so grateful we have this opportunity to still get together and chat once a month. And isn't it beautiful that books are the language that we get to talk to each other in? It's like beyond the banal, right? We love you. We miss you. We get to chat with you, but we get to chat about something important. And so thank you for making time to sit down with us and bring back one of our most favorite things that we do. You know, friends, this is probably a good moment to let you know that Diane and I have been talking a lot about modulating our schedule a bit, and we are going to be recording less frequently going forward and just focusing in on doing more seasonal type work. So most of our stuff will kind of take a break in certain months, particularly the summer. But not this. This is the one show that we want to do every single month because, like I said at the very beginning, this is so good for our self-care and mental health. And we are so grateful for Tanya and Sarah. We wouldn't want to miss out on it. And feedback we've gotten from all of you is you don't want to miss out on it either. So Tanya and Sarah, we know what we're talking about. We've already talked.
We just
compared notes. But we have no idea what you're talking about. Who wants to go first today?
Is Yuna not being currently Sarah?
All right, you so go she first. Is, yep. Sarah should go first.
Mm-hmm. Well, I did not actually read very much this month, partly because I was busy, but also were sick. And it wasn't the kind of sick where you curl up in a bed and read a lot because the whole family was sick. And when you have little kids, that doesn't usually actually help
not at
schedule.
All. It's a lot of caretaking.
So, And normally, you know, I get a lot of reading done through audiobooks when we're out walking and we're home sick. So, but I did actually read the second in that series I talked about last time by Jessica Townsend. So the second one is called Wondersmith, Wonder with a U. And it was fun. Again, I enjoyed it very much. I think similar to the first one, I would say, similar kinds of things that if you're concerned about show up in this one too. But they're very, it's just very engaging storytelling. It really captures you. It was perfect for being sick because you don't have to think really hard. but you enjoy it and it keeps your attention and you want to just keep listening or reading.
So, and just to recap for our listeners, last time the book Sarah was talking about, the first in the series, it's a little bit of fantasy, right? People have compared it to Harry Potter. Is that right?
Yes. It's completely other world. Yeah. People compared it to like Harry Potter or something like that. But it's a different world. It's not even like England. It, you know, like Harry Potter takes place in sort of like an alternate England. This is not any country you've ever heard of.
This is like true fantasy somewhere else entirely.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think we talked about before, it's like the main character, she grows up thinking she's a cursed child. And she's in this kind of one of the regions. And there's apparently, she learns later in the story, a completely other part of, I don't know if it's like the country or the world, right? Like, is this completely other area that like nobody in that lives in the area that she lives in knows about? And they're not supposed to really know about it. It's like the free state kind of
like
a thing.
Resistance.
And she gets pulled into there. Yeah. And she like just learns that what she thought was true was not true. And she has some secret power that she was not aware of that she finds out about at the very end of the first book. And I don't know, there's a lot more to it, but I don't want to give away the story. So
that sounds lovely.
Yeah.
Right now, I happen to be going down that Jennifer Nielsen fantasy track that you and I've talked about, Sarah, and I'm doing Mark and the Thief right now. And it's the same kind of lovely, just like so wonderful escape. There's no heavy duty thinking. It's mm-hmm. got some fun elements, but you know, it's just a nice break from reality.
Yeah. The only other thing I've started, but I'm only, I think, like on chapter 4 or 5, is Ivanhoe. I've never read it before. Oh! I'm so excited. Kwanu's reading it too for Yay! This term. And so Yay! I wanted to read along.
So yeah. How far are you into it? I know you said 4 or 5 chapters, but where are you in it?
Yeah. So they are at, and I'm not going to remember any of the characters' names.
It's okay.
Cedric?
Cedric. No. Mm-hmm, the Saxon. Cedric.
Yeah. So the Saxons. They're at his place. I know that we've been introduced to Ivanhoe, but Kwanu doesn't.
Oh. Is he listening right now? Can he hear you?
Yes, I'm trying to like not speak too loudly, but I think he overheard me.
It's not a huge spoiler, so it's okay.
No. Yeah, I think we're at about the same place, but yeah.
Fun. So,
yeah, they just had the talking about Ivanhoe mm-hmm. at Cedric's place,
at
and Rowena and Cedric were defending him.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's where I'm at. So pretty early on Yay! Still. And what I had heard was that it's a very slow ramp up,
yes.
but that it really picks up and gets, you know, mm-hmm. a lot more engaging. So
yeah, it does. Yeah. It does. Basically, the tournament mm-hmm. is the beginning of the run, so to speak. But you have to, mm-hmm. everything has to conspire for the tournament to happen first. So mm-hmm. a little bit like my in real life book club is doing Ben-Hur right now. It's like, we got to get to the chariot race and then it gets going.
Yeah. You have to be introduced to all the characters and yes. like the setting and all of that. And yeah.
And there are a ton of characters in Ivanhoe mm-hmm. and they all matter.
Mm.
So.
Yeah.
Brett and I were working on a project the other day and we just needed something in the background. So we turned on Ivanhoe to watch.
Oh, fun.
I love the Anthony Andrews version. A lot of people complain that it's too stilted and whatever. I don't know. I think it's visually beautiful. I love it. It's a super fun thing. So if you're looking, Sarah, at some point to like get all the characters square in your head, you could mm-hmm. just watch a few scenes of that and be like, oh,
that's
okay.
a good idea.
This is front to back. That's De Bracy. Yeah.
Yeah.
Because the three knights who are loyal to Prince John, they're all really, really different from each other, but it's really, really hard to keep straight until you can like put a picture to it all, I think.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
And it kind of reminds me, like, you know, when you're reading something that has so many characters and it's so complex. And I had an opportunity with this little school group that I'm doing. We had another homeschool group that had teenagers and they were performing an adaptation of Shakespeare's Twelfth Night and asked if our group would come be an audience for their group. And they were doing two plays, Twelfth Night and one called 14 and Single. So I thought, yes, I'm going to read a retelling to the kids before we go so that we are acclimated to it. So we read Bruce Coville's Twelfth Night, which is
sure
so well done. I love
well
it.
Well done. Yes.
Mm-hmm. But I am not familiar with Twelfth Night myself. I've read and seen a lot of Shakespeare plays, but this is one that I hadn't. And we're reading it. And the kids are like, no, wait, who likes who? And that was whose brother? And now the Duke likes who? And she likes this other guy? And who's in jail? And we could not stop giggling for like 45 minutes because they I had them like eating out of my hand. They were just mesmerized by the story and how funny it is and how delightful it is. But at the same time, we get to the next page. I turn a page and they'd say, who's that now? And I'd be like, I know, we need to draw like a big character map.
Map. Right? Yep,
it's like
absolutely.
You need this big poster on the wall and you can do all the triangles to all the people. Because even I was like, mm-hmm. I don't know, let me turn the page and go back. I'm confused too.
In our packets, we've been doing a better job of including character lists for that very reason, because so often people want a character list, but you want to say who somebody is, but you don't want to spoil the book. And if you go and look online, so often they spoil the book and the character list. So and so who does such and such, which turns out to be such. No, I didn't want to know that.
Who then dies because
yeah.
of this.
You're like, oh, no.
Well, and sometimes in our literature, their names are similar, or they are rhythmic in the same way, or they all start with the
especially
same letter.
Especially in Shakespeare.
Especially in Shakespeare. And so then you're, and then you think, I don't know. I don't know what's happening. It was delightful. We're going to definitely study Twelfth Night a lot more, but the Bruce Coville retelling, some of the retellings of Shakespeare, they might omit complex storylines just to simplify for children.
Or they might sanitize it a little bit.
Well, we did Twelfth Night. We did The Tempest, and I read them three different tellings. Mm-hmm. We're kind of doing like this 5-month study, and I have this like, you know, I just do my own thing. I have my own plan for it. But we did three different retellings, and it was interesting how some of the smaller storylines that add a complexity, different retellers will put in certain things or take certain things out that are complicated that don't really tie into the overall arching story. But with Twelfth Night, Bruce Coville wrote in his author's note that there just really wasn't anything that could be pulled out. Everything was so interlocked and so intertwined that he had to just get it all in. And when you try to do that kind of condensed, I mean, Shakespeare as it is condensed, right? These are 2.5 hour plays. It is a lot happening in a very short time.
Right.
It presents a challenge, right? But so Twelfth Night was just, that's the only retelling I read yet so far. But I thought, oh, that's a good one. I'm going to go buy that book. I borrowed it from my library, but it was so good that I thought I'm going to purchase it. And the illustrations were fantastic.
Cool.
Well, I have a question for you then, since you mentioned The Tempest. I've never read Twelfth Night either. And at the beginning of each year in the homeschool program, I've been trying to do Shakespeare with my older class, like 13 to 17, however old they are in there. And I was thinking of doing The Tempest next time. Mm-hmm. If you had to choose, would you do The Tempest or Twelfth Night? What do you think is better?
I would do Twelfth Night, and I love The Tempest.
Really?
I love The Tempest. But based on now what I've learned about Twelfth Night, I would prioritize that one over The Tempest.
Okay. I will take a look at that one.
I think The Tempest is so humorous and so funny, and I think it's a great way for kids to fall in love with Shakespeare. I do.
Twelfth Night.
Yeah. Okay. Did I say The Tempest?
I was going to say, if The Tempest, yeah.
Sorry, Twelfth
if The
Night.
Tempest is funny, you mean very darkly.
Yeah, The Tempest has some humorous pieces. It has some complex storylines as well. But I feel like Twelfth Night is just that traditional comedy. And there's people dressing up in disguises, and there's misunderstandings, and just all those shenanigans.
Those exhaust me sometimes.
I know. I know. So basically, there's these two siblings. They're in a boat. It gets shipwrecked. They both think the other has died. And the girl lands and wants to go work for the Duke, but he only hires men. So she dresses up as a boy to go work for the Duke. She falls in love with the Duke, but the Duke loves this other person. But this other person falls in love with this girl who's pretending to be a boy. And then it just goes 10 times more complex than that. And it's just hilarious and fun.
Okay. I guess I'd better read it then. Mm-hmm. I try to do, if we do a tragedy one year, I try to do a comedy the next so that they don't hate Shakespeare. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Have you done The Merchant of Venice?
Yes.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. That one's funny too.
I love that one.
Yeah, that's one of my favorites. So I think we might have done that one first.
When you were talking about the plays that you went to see mm-hmm. by another homeschool group, we actually did go to a performance that friends, like one of my homeschooling friends' daughters was in, of Little Women.
Oh.
Oh.
Yay.
Yeah, it was so fun. They did an amazing job. Yeah. So I think that's definitely worth doing. Like, if you can see productions, especially
by
like
other.
Yeah, I think
that's important.
Yes.
That kids are putting on or other homeschoolers. Yeah,
well,
they're so great.
And I think that's what happened seeing Twelfth Night is, I think, for younger kids who might feel a little awkward being on stage or presenting or acting, you see these teenagers doing it and it kind of brings cool factor. And the kids that we watched, you could tell they were really enjoying this acting class that they were in. And it was so funny. So many of the kids, it was good that I read them the story. They were still confused by the story, but then seeing it, even though it was an adaptation, so it was about a 45-minute play. So one of the kids edited it down for the group.
Wow.
So he was the you know, editor of it. And they had such great comedic timing, and they were just having a lot of fun with it, which meant that the children that were watching it, which were 5 to 12 year olds, really enjoyed it. And it just made for such a great experience all around. That's exactly how I feel, Sarah, is if you can see performances, if you can take your kids to see performances of other kids and teenagers performing, it's really worth it.
Mm-hmm. We've done Shakespeare a number of times as well. They have a youth Shakespeare troupe, I guess you'd call it, in San Jose. And we've gone to a number of their performances as well. They're always really well done. This one is the one that did Little Women. They also did, I think it was Narnia, but I'm not sure which part of the story. We didn't end up making it to that one. And then we had also gone recently to Five Children and It, they put on. And these are like pretty professional productions. Like they're all kids that are acting in them, but they do a lot of rehearsals and they do all the work on all the sets and like the parents are involved. And it was like probably 2.5 to 3 hours long. Thankfully, Yuna will sit through pretty much anything. So she enjoyed it too.
One other thing I had been considering was kind of watching and waiting to see what Shakespeare in the Park we get this year. Because we get some people, I think they're from the University of Montana, that come down every summer and do something. And Shakespeare is one of those things where one of the few literary type things where I would tell people you should watch it first and then
agreed.
Read it.
Agreed.
Because that's what it is. It's a play.
Shakespeare's written to be seen, not read.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I thought, well, what if I thought ahead this year and checked on that and then invited all the kids to go to the Shakespeare in the Park and then we read it in the fall.
So that would be.
Wouldn't that be smart?
Let's remind you to do that.
Yeah, I don't know if I can figure it out or not.
I love that idea. So I live in Utah, of course. And in Cedar City, they have the Utah Shakespeare Festival, which is renowned worldwide for the actors that are brought in and for the plays they do. And they do it typically during the summer. I mean, maybe a few in the fall. And when I was in high school, we lived in southern Idaho, but my mom would take us multiple times to go see the Shakespeare Festival. So we would just stay there for 2 or 3 days. And they have a theater there that is modeled off of the Globe.
London.
From London. Yes, it's amazing. And I fell in love with Shakespeare, because my mom loved Shakespeare and we read Shakespeare, but mostly because we went and saw it performed. And even when my husband and I were dating, I remember that we were dating and one time we went and saw The Taming of the Shrew, which I had no idea what it was about.
It's one of my favorites.
That's a fun one to see when you're dating.
True that.
So I think anytime families can have an opportunity to go see Shakespeare, I think it's totally worth it.
I have two related but different things to say about this. First is that in my library, so years ago, I've been doing book clubs in this community for almost a decade, lots and lots of teen book clubs. And during COVID, our book club, of course, had to shut down. And so we went to Zoom and we availed ourselves of the unique platform that Zoom was. And we did a table reading of The Importance of Being Earnest. And so the kids had costumes on and they may have had props in their hands, but there was no acting. I mean, they were acting, but there was no like stage and it was not like memorizing lines because we were on Zoom. So we went around and it was one of their favorite memories of COVID. It was just like we redeemed the time in a way. So this May, my library is doing a table reading of The Importance of Being Earnest again, and all the kids are signing up for big parts or little parts. And I've got little kids that want to do it, and it'll just be hilarious and fun. So even if I just encourage you guys, moms listening, even if you're not feeling like I could make costumes and sets and blocking and all of that, maybe even just do table readings. They're really fun.
Sarah, we are doing the same thing with The Tempest. So my idea with The Tempest was to read with the children a few different retellings, because you get a little bit different flair from a different teller. And you might get pieces of the storyline in one that you didn't get in the other one. So I did Bruce Coville's. I did somebody else's that I cannot think of off the top of my head. And then there is someone who reads Edith Nesbit's version on LibriVox. And her voice is amazing. And she sings the parts that are Ariel's parts. And it's mm-hmm. enchanting. It's mesmerizing. It kind of catches your breath. So I took that and created a slide presentation with fine art from The Tempest that matched the storyline. So the kids would hear the Edith Nesbit telling, and then I was just pacing them through this fine art from all the different scenes as we're reading the story. So we now have this pretty solid, and my kids are 8 to 12-ish, so we have this pretty solid foundation now. And then we're doing a reader's theater.
Nice, yeah.
So we're not memorizing Shakespeare, but that's kind of exactly the same idea. And they'll all have different parts, and we're going to do this reader's theater. So that's how we're this stage doing it. And then later – and then I'm going to show them clips from, like, the Royal Shakespeare Theater of different people doing particular scenes that are the famous scenes.
We actually, for a couple of years during homeschool, we had a subscription to the Globe Theater app. And we then watched a number of those plays, and you could telecast it up onto your TV, you know, like with an Apple TV or something. And so we turned the subtitles on so that you're getting the words while they're being said. And it was one of the most enjoyable experiences we had, because this is pro theater. This is the best Shakespeare you're going to get. I mean, it's just like all the best actors are in it. And so it was such a wonderful way to do that. Then they changed the app, and for whatever reason, we couldn't get it to work for us anymore. I'm sure it works. I think I just got tired of trying to figure it out. But I recommend the Globe Theater app. It's a subscription service. It's not, it used to be affordable. Now it's a little more pricey. But you also get the wide variety. Like, you might be getting Coriolanus set in World War I or something like that. So you'll be getting the different interpretations of it as well, which I think is sort of fun too.
They are a little more bawdy, for sure, than like a children's production of Shakespeare.
Yes.
I've seen a couple of them.
So the other related thing I have to share is sort of fun. So this I am not recommending for children. I'm recommending this for moms. And it's not a book. I am loving, there's only 4 seasons. It's a BBC show, so I watch it through my BritBox subscription on Prime, called Shakespeare and Hathaway. And they are private detectives, Luella Shakespeare and Frank Hathaway, and their offices are in Stratford. And they have Sebastian is their out of work actor who does a lot of undercover for them. He's hilarious. And it's so fun because sort of like little murder mystery type things. It feels like a little Father Brown, a little Murder, She Wrote, that kind of a thing. And it's mostly wholesome, secular worldly, but mostly pretty wholesome. All of the shows, you know who the characters are going to be if you know Shakespeare, because they're named for the characters in Shakespeare. And so everyone has a different theme based on one of his plays. So it's fun.
I want to watch that. So it's on my to-do list because you told me about it.
I guarantee it.
I have to finish this other series I'm in, and then that's the one I'm going to.
And it's a lot easier to find that than Foyle's War, which I also recommended and love. This one is meant to be funny. Like, it's charming and hilarious. So
before we move on from Shakespeare, for people who are teaching Shakespeare, and we're talking about, I've been doing it, you know, with a younger group, Diana's doing it with older students. I did come across a book called Shakespeare's Storybook, Folk Tales That Inspired the Bard. And so I'm going to show you guys a picture of it, but we'll link it in the show notes. My library had it. I ended up buying it because I loved it so much. But there are probably 7 or 8 plays that the idea was that he was inspired by a folk tale, and it tells these folk tales and then tells you which play Shakespeare would have used. So there's one called The Devil's Bet, and that's The Taming of the Shrew. The Hill of Roses, that's Romeo and Juliet. So it has one for The Merchant of Venice, As You Like It, Hamlet, King Lear, and The Winter's Tale. So, and it's beautifully illustrated as well, and it gives a little overview of Shakespeare's play, and then it does the retelling of the folktale. So I thought it was a really cool resource if you were doing any
of
those
like
plays.
Tales before Tolkien, and I forget what the Narnia component is, but that there it's a compendium of the source material, the things that Tolkien read and loved. And I forget what the, like I said, I can't remember what the Narnia one is, but I have both. They're by the same author, And it's such a wonderful way into those stories. That's how I found out about Edith Nesbit's story, The Aunt and Amabelle, which is one of the source material for the wardrobe, because Amabelle goes into a wardrobe and all of that. I love those kinds of books.
Yeah, I do too. And I like knowing maybe what would have been around in the author's time that was influencing, like maybe what they read during their childhood or had been read to them as children.
Or was popular at the time.
So
very interesting. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I haven't read too many of the actual tales yet, but it was a book that I came across and thought, oh, that's lovely. Borrowed it from my library, really liked it, and have it as part of the resources now for future Shakespeare teaching.
Very cool. Well, who wants to go next?
Okay. So other than Shakespeare this month, which is something I've been focusing on, I've been reading. I feel like I'm just in a season of really wanting to dive into a lot of educational things, but that's not always super interesting conversation. Sometimes it is. I'm reading a book called Let's Play Math.
No.
Have you guys heard of that? I feel sad that I didn't read it 8 years ago. It's a really fascinating look at teaching math and incorporating math. It's by a woman named Denise Gaskins. Mm. Let's Play Math, How Families Can Learn Math Together and Enjoy It. But it's just a way of looking at how to incorporate math in a different way. And there was a quote in there. I know a lot of people talk about, maybe I'm never going to do calculus. Do I actually need to learn calculus? And there's a statement that she makes in here where she says, you know, does anybody really need to read Shakespeare? You know, do you actually need that? Mm-hmm. And she talks about how there is such a beauty and a depth to Shakespeare, and it's interesting. Mm-hmm. The stories speak to humanity, and it's good for humans and for people and for children to read Shakespeare because of how enriching the stories are and what it teaches us about ourselves. And she talks about how when we're looking at math, it's not whether or not you're ever going to need to use calculus. It's more about that it's so creative and interesting, and it helps us actually tap into creativity and problem solving and learn confidence. Mm. And it's puzzle solving. Mm-hmm. And when you get to have those aha moments, it can make life kind of come alive. Like Shakespeare, when you read Shakespeare and great literature, life starts to have a shading and a tint to it that ends up being deeper than maybe had you not.
Yeah.
Same with learning to actually think about the world in a different way through numbers. And you can start to make these connections and things are relational. And Shakespeare does the same sort of thing. I struggled through school feeling like I understood math. Like I got straight A's and did really well, but whether I could actually apply it, it was more I was really good at learning it and following the procedure, but did I really understand it? And the idea here is that so many people cannot recall or remember or enjoy something they do not understand.
Right, 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 right.
So it's just a really interesting book. So I'm just putting it out there to read it because I really wish I would have read it as a younger mom and had that kind of as part of my repertoire. And the connection to the Shakespeare idea was so awesome.
Yeah.
I liked it.
Before we completely leave Shakespeare, I should admit that the fiction I just got done reading and just wrote a book review on is The Shakespeare Stealer.
And oh, you did?
I did. I haven't posted the review. Diane just proofed it today. I read it and I was not aware that there are actually a few more, that it was a series. I thought it was just a one-off. But it stands alone very nicely all by itself. It's a really delightful book. It's well done. It's interesting and it's fun. And the basic idea is that there is an orphan boy who is, I won't say adopted, that would be the wrong word, but you know, this is set in Shakespeare's time. And so the boy is claimed by a doctor and preacher who has this interesting shorthand, and it's his own, by his own division. And he recruits this kid to become his apprentice, and this kid then learns the shorthand, and then he sends him out to go out and steal the sermons of other pastors. And so then he can go and use those sermons himself in his little hamlet. And somebody becomes aware of this and ultimately buys him. His name is Widge, buys Widge in order to get him to steal Shakespeare's new play, Hamlet. And the only thing that Widge can do because of a series of events is to go, you know, quote unquote, undercover with the company. And he learns, you know, he goes on a journey of self-discovery. He learns a lot about the theater. He learns a lot about Shakespeare himself. And it's a fascinating look into how a play is made and how a play is preserved. How do the people who actually own the play get to maintain their rights to the play when it's being stolen by people in the crowd? It's just a very interesting story. Really, really great for, you know, 12 to 16-year-old type readers. And one that I think I might do a book club on at some point because it's fun. Now that we're done with Shakespeare, unless, does anybody else have anything else Shakespeare to talk about? So then, Tanya, what else are you reading this month?
Okay, so I know that you and Diane have read this and probably maybe Sarah, but I really want to discuss the brilliance of A Long Road on a Short Day by Gary Schmidt.
Yes, yes.
Wow, right? You guys, I think it should be on a list of every family should read this in the 8 to 12-year-old range.
Yep.
As much as Little Britches.
Yeah.
It's brilliant. Mm-hmm. And it's so elegant in how it tells the story without pushing any sort of a moral. Mm-hmm. I read it and I'm reading it to Ava, right? And mm-hmm. I just can't get over how brilliant it is. It's so clever. His writing is so clever.
He truly is a master. He can write really long novels. He can write these beautiful, charming picture books. He can write these stories about the Holocaust. There's really very little. I'm convinced and as Diane and I talked to him about in our interview with him, he's working now on a graphic novel. I mean, there's just very little that Gary D. Schmidt can't write.
Yeah. This is probably one of my very favorite books for children. The relationship between the dad and the son, the whole family dynamic, you don't really have too much with the mom, except that you understand. So just for our readers, mm-hmm. the essence of the story is there's this family. And I think either they have a newborn or a baby's coming. And the mom really wishes she had a milk cow. Mm-hmm. And so the dad has a knife and he decides that he can trade it. And he's going to see what kind of trades he can make because he knows how much his wife needs this milk cow.
Yeah.
And so it's a very short wintry day and him and the son go out and start to make a trade, the knife for something else and then that thing for something else.
Right.
And each time the son thinks, oh, I really wish my mom – you know, wanted this pony
instead of the milk cow. I wish we could have the kitten. I wish we could have the pony, right?
I wish we could have the puppy mm-hmm. instead of the the milk cow. And it's interesting because as they're going along, the weather's getting worse mm-hmm. and they're meeting these different people in the community that also have different needs and they're making these trades. So again, I'm loving the community aspect of just the different types of people that are living in this community, from farmers to doctors to a widow who actually was quite wealthy, and the trades that they can make and the importance of everyone creating kind of this win-win proposition for everyone mm-hmm. until they are able to meet the goal. And I cried multiple times through it. Looking at me and I was like, I just can't. It's just so beautiful. And you can feel the kind of heartache of the boy as he has to think outside of his self. Like many children are self-centric. Mm-hmm. They perceive things through their wants and their needs. Mm-hmm. And it's really difficult sometimes to make sacrifices for someone else because that is a greater need.
Right.
Someone that you love
right.
because it's a greater need. And Gary D. Schmidt just writes that so perfectly. It's just such a perfect story. And I just loved it. And I think everyone should read it.
He does do such an amazing job of this boy is really pretty young. I don't remember if it says how old he is, but his dad is taking him out and showing him how to be a man without preaching to him. He doesn't say, now, son, did you learn anything from that last exchange mm-hmm. we had? He's doing the manly thing and the boy is observing and he's participating where he's mm-hmm. able mm-hmm. and he comes away with a lot of lessons without any preaching.
And he doesn't.
And everybody ends up happy without magically getting everything
That's
they wanted.
Exactly it. Right.
Exactly.
Exactly. He doesn't get the puppy. He gets the respect of the people he goes to visit because he behaves so well.
He does get the puppy, right?
He does get a bonus puppy. But there's the complexity of when he really wants the pony and the cart. Mm-hmm. And he says to his dad, this would really help us on the farm. If we had this, the things that I could do and the way I could help
right.
would grow exponentially. And the dad says, you are absolutely right. You are not wrong in that. And then the boy even says, our opportunity to have something like this happen again probably won't for a really long time. And the dad says, mm-hmm. you are right. Another opportunity to have a pony in a cart like this might not come until you're in your teens, like much, much later.
Right.
And there's this critical moment where they just have to still weigh the need.
Yes.
Was that need higher than the need that the mom had requested of having this milk cow?
That's right.
And, you know, that's these are the kinds of questions that are complex and is so worthy of consideration.
Right. Because children or even us, we always want particular things and it might not be the right season for those things. Or maybe it's the right season, mm-hmm. but the resources are simply lacking. We have to right. know how to be content with what we have and satisfied that they actually took care of the actual need, which was the milk cow. They needed the milk cow.
And the commitment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because the need for the milk cow wasn't dire. Mm-mm. Nobody was going to die if they didn't get it. No one was sick or anything. But when they left the house, that was the point. We're going to do what mom asked us right. to do. And I think that that's significant too, where okay, the pony and the cart, that would be, that's a legitimate thing. Mm-hmm. Maybe we could, if we came home with that, would mom be happy? Yes, probably so. Mm-hmm. Would we have accomplished the goal we set out to accomplish? No. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And you can't just take off on every little
whim,
rabbit trail that catches your mm-hmm. eye. Yeah. Mm-hmm. When you have a goal in mind.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. For such a short story, mm-hmm. because it is a short story, you could read it in a sitting, mm-hmm. a long sitting, admittedly, but a mm-hmm. long sitting. It's just so succinct and so expressed so well. It doesn't overuse words. It doesn't underuse words.
No,
it's the right. ideas. I thought it was so epically brilliant. I loved it.
Well, and yes, Tanya, I did review that one.
You did? Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Yeah.
I probably knew that and probably because we've talked about Gary D. Schmidt and I probably even skimmed some of them, but I finally sat down and read it and then was just again blown away again with his diversity too mm-hmm. of storytelling because it's mm-hmm. much different than some of the other stories that he had told. So I know that our listeners know that we love Gary D. Schmidt and I haven't come across one that I didn't love yet.
Well,
but
you haven't read Trouble or Orbiting Jupiter yet. Those will break your heart.
But will I still like them?
You will love Gary D. Schmidt for having written yeah. them.
Yes, exactly. Like I'll understand mm-hmm. their purpose.
Yes.
Orbiting Jupiter's beautiful.
Yes. Yeah.
So it was interesting because we just did the Wednesday Wars in one of our library book clubs and I do a lot of hand selling in the library. And in fact, we moved some furniture this weekend to put up more display space because I have all these little acrylic record shelves that we put books on. And so I am just putting books, turning them out and tempting people for them all the time. And there was a group of moms standing around the doorway where some of the books were on display. And they're like, Gary D. Schmidt I had Almost Time and Long Walk on a Short Day both on display. And they're like, what? And they were totally puzzled by that because they were thinking of him as Wednesday Wars. And I said, you guys got to take these out. They of course went out right away. People were like, yeah, okay, let's try that.
Yeah. I do want to clarify. Maybe he named it wrong. I think it should be A Long Walk on a Short Day, and it's A Long Road on a Short Day. And I don't know why, but my mind, maybe because they were walking and walking and walking, mm-hmm. I think of it as a long walk. But for anyone looking for it, we do know that it's called A Long, long road on a short day.
Yes.
Yeah. So kind of leading into the next one, I just have this one other picture book. A Long Road on a Short Day is a short chapter book.
Right.
With minimal illustrations. So there's a picture book that I absolutely love. And I used it, I think I told you guys that I was doing with my kids kind of a personal development class where using story to help them think about how to think about things like failure,
right,
or managing frustration.
Yep.
I think because I now have three adult children and I'm still raising Ava, one of the things that I think most kids that are launching to the world really need is they need help thinking about ways about how to think about things and how to think about success, how to think about failure, how to manage the amount of data that's being sent at them and the messages that are being sent at them, and maintaining their value and their worth and their ideals. So I've been looking for stories. So there is a book called Saturday. And I don't really know how you say the author's name, but her last name is Mora, M-O-R-A. Hmm. And the premise of the story, I'm just going to give the whole thing away. So spoiler alert right off the bat here, is there's a little girl and her mom works 6 days a week. So she works Sunday through Friday and her only day off is Saturday. And so they look forward to Saturday to be together so much.
Sure.
And they usually have a big plan for Saturday. So the little girl is named Ava. So my Ava loved it. But they're going to do four things this coming Friday. So they get up and they get ready and it's going to be the best day ever. And they get all of their stuff together and they go to the library for story time, and story time has been canceled.
Oh,
and
no.
And the mom says, okay, it's okay. And they take a deep breath and they say, okay, we still have three more things on our list today. It's going to be a great day. So they go to the salon where they're getting their hair done.
Oh.
So they go to the salon and they get their hair done and they are looking all fine. And they walk out and a big bus goes through a puddle and the puddle comes completely up over them and their hair is destroyed.
Oh.
And they take a deep breath and they look at each other and they say, okay, it's going to be fine. We still have two more things scheduled for today. And they were going to have a quiet, peaceful picnic in the park together. So they walk over to the park and they get there and there is this huge band playing and it's really loud and the park is crowded with tons and tons of people. And it's so loud they can't even hear each other trying to talk to each other. And Ava is feeling really upset and the mom says, you know what? It's okay. We'll just skip the picnic in the park, because we have these tickets to go to the puppet play and it's going to be amazing as long as we don't miss that bus. And they go running for the bus and they make it to the bus just in the nick of time, and they get to the theater and the person asks for the tickets and the mom opens her purse and she puts her hand inside the purse and pulls out nothing because she left the ticket sitting on the kitchen counter.
Oh, no.
And at this moment, I know, I cry. Okay, yeah. Just be prepared. I cried. The mom crumples down into a big heap and she's just so upset. And she says, I'm so sorry, Ava. I've just ruined this whole day. Everything has gone wrong. And now we can't even do the puppet play.
Oh.
And you turn the page and you see Ava pause. She has a moment. She pauses and she takes a deep breath. And she says, it's okay, Mom. We spent the whole day together and just being together is all that matters.
Yeah.
And then they go home and they open the door and they both say, but, and they create their own puppet play together and they make believe together. And that's the end of the story. Isn't that so lovely?
Yes. Yes.
And the illustrations are darling and it's just such a cute book.
Yay. Is that a newer book or an older one?
Yeah, it's newer. Actually, the illustrator won a Caldecott for another book.
Oh, okay.
Thank you, Omu. So
super fun. Well, Diane, what about you? What are you reading?
Well, I have been a little busy and haven't done a ton of reading either. And so I've kind of been, mostly what I've been accomplishing is my Kindle book that I take to bed. And of course, it's always something a little bit off the beaten trail. But this last one is called Armadale. And it's by Wilkie Collins, who wrote The Moonstone and The Woman in White. And so those two are his most famous ones. And
is this one a mystery as well?
There is a mystery, but it isn't so much about solving anything. There's a mystery. But it isn't like a murder mystery or something about, like with The Moonstone, where something's stolen.
Have you read The Moonstone? I'm just curious. It's been on my to-read list for a million years. Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
you have.
It's good. It's long and complicated, and it's not like getting through a modern day mystery story. Mm. There's a lot to it. You have to have some patience.
Okay.
But I guess this one was his longest one. On Kindle, it can be a little bit hard to tell exactly how long you're going and where you are. I mean, I can see what percentage I am, but when you're holding a book that's 600 to 800 pages long, it's a little bit different. Yeah. So I guess one reason I wanted to mention this is that it just kind of also goes along with my, if you remember, my detective novel notebook.
Yes.
Part of the reason I went back a couple years ago and read The Moonstone and The Woman in White was that it sort of goes back on the trail of looking for the very earliest detective novels. And so he was a very early writer of detective novels. The Moonstone is one of the first. And there's an argument about who wrote the first actual detective novel. And, well, wait a minute, what do you mean, like the American one or the British one? So there's this one, the one I read before this was Aurora Floyd by Mary Elizabeth Braddon, and she was one of the first women detective story writers. And then also one of the more recent ones was Anna Katharine Green, and this one was called The Mayor's Wife. And so it goes along with my detective novel research, but also one of the things that I really absorb about these, and it's not something that's necessarily easy to explain and say, well, in this book, the theme was that, and in this book, the theme was that. And I put all these together and got this picture of the time. But it kind of is, because you start to notice a theme as far as like what they take for themes of the novel and the things that are considered so important. Mm. Because in this one of the things has to do with marriage is very important. How people back then, you know, you didn't get married if your parents didn't approve. You didn't marry somebody outside of your social class. It was very important for an heir, you know, to be able to trace who was the heir and to make sure that the fortune went to the right person and that person definitely married the right kind of person. And another theme that you see a lot of times is legitimacy or illegitimacy of children.
Right.
Or one of the really serious problems in a mystery novel can have to do with somebody who maybe thinks their spouse died, so they get married to somebody else, and then they find out that the spouse is alive. And so what do you do? What happens if everybody finds out that you're a bigamist?
Oh, yeah.
You know, your life will be destroyed because this is against the law. You could go to prison for that kind of thing. And it's just interesting to me to see how people back then handled some of these really deep questions, how serious it was to them, and how these days we'd probably go, yeah, well, you know, you didn't do it on purpose, but there's ways to fix this. What are you worried about here? Illegitimate children? Yeah, it happens.
We don't even think of it that way anymore. We just have all these. Well, you have a partner, and you may have children with your partner. Whether you're married,
and then you go get a different one. Yeah, But these were so serious. Part of it is succession to a fortune or a title. So, like in this one, there are two men, young men about the same age, who have the same name. And their last name, their names are Alan Armadale, but one of them has been going by an alias for various reasons. And they're not related by blood, but there's a related reason that they both have the same name. And one of them knows the history of it and the other one doesn't. And the one thinks that he's fated to ruin the life of the other one. And so he keeps trying to, they become very good friends. They love each other like brothers, but the one is always very melancholy because he thinks that he's fated to ruin his life. Mm. And it's, so it's another question of like, are you fated to do anything? Can you do anything against fate? No matter, you know, does it matter what you do? Are you going to end up the same way no matter what? So I don't know. It is just kind of a thing where I sort of absorb the time period. Mm-hmm. And then one of the other little time period things that I was noticing this time is the way that they send notes back and forth to each other, writing to each other, like from London to these outskirts towns and however far it is to get there by train. And they write to each other and go, I'll expect your answer by the next post. And they get it the next day. Well, wait a minute. It's Tuesday and I thought I would get that letter. It better come tomorrow. And they're just back and forth with the mail. Like, how do you do that? Our mail isn't even that reliable anymore. But apparently you can just get people to run your letters back and forth. And
they usually had two services a day. So there was usually the morning post and the evening post.
And you can just send your messenger and wait for an answer. Mm-hmm. So you're, oh gosh, there's someone outside waiting for me to write this letter. I better hurry up, or maybe I'm not going to send it. Or anyway, it's just a completely different lifestyle, because you think of things like, okay, we know that they didn't have cars. They had horses and there were trains and they could have traveled all these different ways. And there were other certain things they didn't have. But the mail, it's just the story in a lot of places hinges on the mail. And boy, would we be in trouble if we had to do that.
You say that you keep reading all of these books, right? They're all connected by time period and so on. I get the impression that you're stepping into this world, and that is that part of the appeal for you, to just be living in this other world? Mm-hmm. And that's why you just keep reading related books?
That is part of it, yeah.
But they tend to be detective novels, obviously. So why detective novels? What's so intriguing to you?
Well, that was just one of the things I like to do, is find out what was the first ever of a genre. Because you can't go back and find all of those. But like with The Virginian is considered the first Western.
Right.
So what is that like, and where did that go from there? Who got popular? And with detective novels, you know, you really can go back to a time when there wasn't one, unless you want to consider some of the apocryphal stories, like, is it the Judith or Susanna? Or when Daniel solves the mystery of the dragon that seems to be... You're looking at me like you don't know, so maybe
no
I'll just
idea
leave
what
that
you're
part
talking
out
about.
There. You can.
I'm wondering, okay. Did I just like enter into a different world here?
And I can't think of any titles right now because I wasn't ready for that. But you can go back to ancient times and find out there are some mysteries.
Oh,
like,
yeah,
there's an apocryphal story about Daniel figuring out that this supposed the idol that eats the offerings, there's really somebody, there's a passage underneath where they go in and take those away and the priests are eating it, I think is what it is. But all the worshipers think that it's a dragon or something.
Right, got it.
That's very vague. Anyway, that's what happened, was I just started off trying to find out what was the earliest detective novel? We know Edgar Allan Poe was there writing some short ones, but then what? And then when I realized a lot of the earliest ones were women, I thought, that is weird to think about Victorian women sitting around writing stories about these evil people.
These buttoned up, refined women writing essentially potboilers.
And a lot of them have to, they usually have a lot of different pen names, or write as men, because they couldn't be known like that.
Exactly.
And then if you think about like Agatha Christie, everybody's heard of her and she seems like the biggest that ever was, but there were people before her. Anna Katharine Green wrote in the late 1800s, and she had a woman who was a single older woman named Amelia Butterworth, and she's much like Miss Marple.
Mm.
And there's a Mr. Grice that's kind of he could be a precursor to Poirot or some of those other ones like that. I just find that interesting, that there's nothing new under the sun, but there was a time when certain things were pretty new, and then they go away and we forget where the things we know came from.
Right. So the other thing that you've been reading and I've been reading is Rascal. And I read Rascal years ago, but I think I was in the wrong place. I wasn't feeling very well, I think, when I read it. And I never read it as a child, which I can't understand why in the state of Wisconsin I never read Rascal.
Right. Well, because people forget about things.
Well, there we go.
Yeah.
So I remember reading it and thinking it was fine. It's a good boy book. Good. Wonderful. Moving on with my life. And then you just love Rascal and you kept, you know, you wrote an entire, you did a whole thing on our website for Rascal. And when we were talking about which packets to create, you were saying, I think we should do Rascal. And I said, yeah, I think we should do, we shouldn't waste your work. So I should go back and reread Rascal just so we can work on this together. And I found myself just like needing to read Rascal. Like this was so good. It was so good. I couldn't put it down.
It's about time.
I know. I don't know. Like what was wrong with me before now? It is one of my favorite reads of the last year.
It's my like my lifelong quest to get somebody else to love 101
right.
Dalmatians.
Been there, done that. You have nailed that, Diane.
Yeah. I did not read Rascal when I was a child. I didn't discover that until I was homeschooling my kids.
But I live here.
Right.
And so it's interesting because I think you and I like different things in Rascal. I mean, I think we generally like the whole thing, but I particularly loved all of the woods. The fly fishing. And I loved figuring out where he was in Wisconsin and what Wisconsin looked like at that time. And the fact that it's a true story, it just blows my mind that he really did have this raccoon that he got as a kit and raised up. And I don't want to spoil the ending, but I love how nature takes its course in the end. And it's sad, but not tragic. And it's like, oh, yeah, okay.
It ends pretty much the way anybody with a wild animal for a pet has to end.
Well, there are a couple of ways. This was the happier way.
Yeah.
He has another book, though, called Raccoons Are the Brightest People.
Oh, I didn't know that. Mm-hmm. Oh.
So I think he spent time with raccoons.
Oh, that makes sense.
And had at least another book about raccoons. I don't know exactly. I haven't read that one.
Oh, well, we need to find that.
I was just going to say, he's one of those people that a couple of his books stayed famous and stayed on the lists. And then a lot of the rest of the ones just went away.
Right. So, Tanya, have you read Rascal?
I haven't. It's been on my to read list. I think Diane should make a list of all the books that she thinks are so amazing that no one else talks about all the time. And you and I will just work our way through the list.
One a month.
Well, there's Lorna Doone.
I've read Lorna Doone and love Lorna Doone. So
Diane
loves to complain that nobody likes the books, but I always do. Sarah, what about you? Have you ever read Rascal?
No.
Okay.
I have. And I don't know if Kwanu has.
You guys,
I can't remember.
You need to take care of this. This is not even a long book.
Apparently, right?
Exactly.
Oh, it is such a wonderful look into like naturalism and, I don't know. What can we say to persuade them, Diane? How should we summarize why this book is
You don't
so...
have to say anything. Diane said she loved it. She needs everyone to read it. I went and read 101 Dalmatians, and I loved it. So we'll get her done.
Get her done.
I think when I first read it, I loved it because boys love it. Mm-hmm. There's so much boy stuff in it. He's a real boy. Mm-hmm. He has a freedom that hardly anybody else ever had.
And that's a combination of factors.
Boys could yearn for.
Yeah, that's like time period, right? Mm-hmm. It's a more free time period.
Right.
And it comes down to his mom is dead, so he just has his dad. And his sisters, they raised him most of the way, but then once they left, dad is sort of like, he's a little bit like Atticus, To Kill a Mockingbird. He treats Sterling the way that Atticus treats Scout, I think.
Mm-hmm. Except maybe even more hands off because he's just gone a lot of time.
And there's no housekeeper. And he gone for on a trip for 5 or 6 days. And Sterling's by himself. Yeah. And in the meantime, he's found a raccoon and brought it in the house and made it his friend.
How old is the boy in the story?
12.
And it's autobiographical. So this is Sterling's own story.
Oh, I love that.
He's one of four kids. He has an older brother who's fighting in the war. This is World War I. And he has two sisters who are, one is married and one is away in graduate school. And his sisters, after his mom died when he was very, very little, his sisters sort of did a lot of raising of him. And he loves and adores all of his family. Like he just, He has so much affection and respect for each member of his family. Even when he says, well, she can be this way. He still says it, but we love her anyway.
Like when they object to him building a canoe in the living room.
Right, for months. And
his dad doesn't care.
His dad does not care at all. she's so efficient about it. Like, what is it going to take to get this canoe out of the living room so we can have Christmas? Oh, he needs canvas? Okay, let's just give him canvas for Christmas. Let's just get that done. Now we can stretch it and take it out into the garage. It is a lovely, charming story. It feels like Little Britches in a way. It feels a little bit like To Kill a Mockingbird without the drama. And like the domestic scenes feel like To Kill a Mockingbird. And as we've been working on our packet for it, Diane was doing a lot of research, like all the different skills he has. Tying flies for fly fishing, the leather working, the canoe stretching, like the building of a canoe, the woodworking that goes into that, and just the sewing. And there are so many things that he just does. And boys are like, I want to do that.
Mm-hmm. Well, the next time I read it was because I was looking for books that had to do with World War I when I was researching that time period. And that's what this is. It's a snapshot of a small American town whose boys have gone away to World War I. How were they handling that? Mm-hmm. What was it like then? And what were the things they were doing for the war effort?
Mm-hmm. And Sterling gets the Spanish flu in the story. And so he, by the grace of God, didn't have it badly, but he had to go out. Then his dad just can't nursemaid him. So his dad takes him out to Sterling's aunt and uncle's farm. And his aunt loves him as if he were her own fourth son. Cause she's got three strapping farm boys of her own. And so the aunt and uncle just take care of him for 4 or 6 weeks while he recovers from the flu and has time with his aunt and uncle milking the cows, and he brings his raccoon with him.
Of course. Can't leave him home.
And everybody finds this raccoon to be enchanting.
Well, not the neighbor whose corn
that's
he keeps
true.
Eating.
That's true. So he had a stay of execution by getting the flu. He took Rascal with him to the farm. Mm-hmm. So it's just a wonderful story dealing with this, a little bit of the Spanish flu, a little bit of World War I, a little bit of America at a time when it was settled but still pretty wild. And, I mean, for the boys out there who love anything outdoorsy, whether it's taking your canoe down the river at night, or it's fly fishing, or it's hiking, or it's tracking animals in the woods. A lot of father-son themes in there that are really lovely. Dad is distant, but not unloving. He's really more of an absent-minded professor than anything else.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. One of the things that I was struck by as far as the Wisconsin and forest and outdoorsy stuff is that the dad and a lot of other people that he meets are always talking about how it used to be.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So we think of this as so far back and how primitive it would have been. And they're talking about, well, I remember when this was really primitive.
Right.
Back when these kinds of birds lived here, or back when there were no cabins or whatever it was. Mm-hmm. Or I remember this guy talking about what he remembered when no one was here but Indians.
Right. And that's an important point, too, is that there's an entire bird that they talk about quite a bit that doesn't exist anymore in Wisconsin because they were all hunted to extinction. And so there's those kinds of conversations as well. It's really just very life-giving and delightful and funny.
Yes, it is.
So we're both reading Rascal. And then do you have anything else you're reading, Diane? Or should I talk about Lad?
Go ahead and talk about Lad. I just will say that I did actually get back through The Labors of Hercules Beale again.
Yay!
So just to note another accomplishment.
Yes, I have to get back into it myself. When we're done with Railway Children and Rascal.
But I've been doing nothing.
Because friends, we are doing a book club guide for The Labors of Hercules Beale. Well, let's talk about something that some people think is offensive. This month, I have been reading Lad, The Story of a Dog by Terhune. And I was reading it because, well, Anthony is republishing it through Living Book Press, and the cover is gorgeous, and I'm a dog person, and I've never read it, and I know my grandfather loved it, so I was curious. So I got it, and I sat on it, I didn't do anything with it because I was busy, and then in one of the groups I'm in, there was this whole conversation about, well, don't you know that that book is racist? And I thought, racist? Why would Anthony would not publish a racist book. What is the story behind this? So I thought, this is the moment. I'm going to jump in and I'm going to read this book. Now, I'm not entirely done yet. I'm almost there. And I will have a review for it shortly, maybe even in time for this, for when this show notes post for this. But I'm going to vote not racist. So in what I have read, I'm going to say not racist. I am going to say that there are some things that I think might be triggering that comment from people. And so there are things that perhaps people will want to know. I think the thing that people would be more likely to be concerned about, although I don't find it concerning at all, is the violence in Lad, because dogs in their natural habitat are in fact violent, especially when you have a dog like Lad, whose entire job it is as a collie is to protect his master's land. And so when a burglar comes in and Lad has the burglar pinned on the floor and he has the burglar's throat in his jaws, that's pretty violent for a child's book. But I think it's totally and completely appropriate. So
yeah, it's heroic.
It is heroic. And I think that we as a culture have become unnecessarily squeamish. And I understand that every family has their own standard, and I am definitely not judging anybody. But I'm saying as a culture, we are so quick to throw the baby out with the bathwater. The writing level of Lad is excellent, truly excellent. You can see why this book is on the lists of classics for children to read. It is complex. There are complex thoughts, extremely sophisticated language. I had to look up words in this book, and I read a lot. The writing itself is a rich, rich feast. The story is very interesting. And because it was published originally in serial, what you have are each chapter is its own little story. And so you could easily read one and walk away and do some other things, then come back and read another one, and they would stand alone, and yet they're still you know, kind of situated together.
But because weren't these written for magazines?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And they were not written for children's magazines.
These are not actually for children. In my experience with Lad, I think a middle school student could get something out of it. I think a high school student would get a lot out of it. And I really enjoy it for my own mother culture. I find it fascinating to see the inside of the show dog world. I think it's fascinating to look inside of kind of American life during, because this is also a World War I book. So to what life was like at that time. And, you know, when they were trying to make sure that people, like there's a one guy who goes around and tries to convince all the landowners to kill their dogs because the dogs are a drain on the economy during a difficult time. Right. But these are the kinds of conversations that do happen in this book. And of course, the master is not going to let that happen. We don't know his name. Lad's mm-hmm. owner is just the master. So getting back to, though, the parts that people might think are racist is that that burglar is a black person. And so people, I think, see that and think that what he's saying here is the only black character in the book happens to be a burglar. And so therefore, black people are bad guys, according to Terhune. Therefore, this book is racist. There's another incident where there is a German immigrant who's working for a landowner, and he does some pretty not nice things. And the master keeps referring to him as that German, get your German off of my property. And it is pejorative. You can tell that. And there's a little bit of like bias against the German just for being German. But again, this is being written and published right after the war. And so people have sort of those sensibilities. So in my estimation, this book is, I think, very easily compared to Gene Stratton Porter. both in writing style, kind of time period, in sort of the love of nature and animals being who they are, what they're created to be. I think Porter, I don't know, do you know, Diane, did Porter ever read Terhune?
I don't know.
It seems like she would have.
Especially since he was in some of the same magazines,
right.
I think.
It seems like these two would have been friends if they had known each other. Mm-hmm. So, and then I think that the characterization of people groups and the ethnic references, I think that that is sort of on the same level as a Jean Stratton Porter novel. So I don't find, again, I haven't finished the book yet, but I'm almost there, and I haven't found any clear racism of any kind.
Well, one of the points that I like to make about the way she characterizes people by their ethnicity, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. and the way it was done a lot of times there, is that a lot of these people, they were fresh off the boat. Mm-hmm. And so not only did they have a German sounding last name and they were hard to identify, they still had the accent, yes. and a lot of the culture. And that's how you identified them rather than, you know, that guy who lives down the street who wears overalls all the time. You know, the guy who lives down the street who makes sauerkraut.
Yes, yes.
Because he's a German and that's what he did over there. In her books, most of the time when she identifies someone that way, she's just saying that's how these people are. And I think it was more true then because they hung together in communities and behaved in a certain way like they did in the old country that we don't see anymore.
Well, and there's a storyline with a Scottish shepherd. So the actual shepherd, the man is Scottish. So he has an understanding of collies that goes way back. It's an ancestral understanding. And so it would be ridiculous to tell this story and not identify him as the Scot, because it is his Scottish heritage and ancestry that clearly defines his role and his understanding. And his understanding of how sheep are and how collies are is totally different than the Americans there. So you have these blending of cultures, but the Americans don't, at this point, weren't typically keeping sheep and herding them with collies. So the Scot was imported, as were the sheep, as was the dog. All of these things were imported from Scotland to sort of take root here. So I think that there's an ethnic understanding of that too, that we're not just talking about the immigration of a person, where we're talking about an immigration of a culture and a way of life and ancestral practices, mm-hmm. and how that rubs some of the characters the wrong way. It's an interesting thing. And for us to assume that these things aren't, I mean, I don't think it's racist to talk about that this is what it takes to have a melting pot country.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it wasn't always pretty.
Everybody had to sort of rub against each other and learn from each other, good and bad. So I enjoy the book very much. I love dogs very, very, very much. And I find the dog violence to be appropriately sad in the right places and appropriately exciting and heroic in other places. This is not James Herriot. It's a little more assertive than James Herriot. But it would be, if you have animal lovers, this is really fascinating stuff. And so if James Herriot and Jean Stratton Porter were trying to tell a story about collies, this is what you would get, I guess.
The kind of the level of violence reminds me Call of the Wild or yeah. White Fang. I really love Jack London. I've read those stories multiple times and I really, really like them. So it reminds me a little bit of that, what you're saying.
Yeah, definitely.
Oh, I did too. And he wrote like that because he lived right in it. And he's saying, this is how it is. Mm-hmm. This is nature for you. Mm-hmm.
And it forms a deep mm-hmm. impression on you, I think. Mm-hmm. These animal stories, they have the capacity to stay inside us and live inside us. Not that, and I don't exactly know why that is, other than the fact that the Lord in the Garden of Eden made us the stewards of all of the creatures. And so I think that we have an inherent God-given curiosity about animals and a care for them and a desire to understand what that is like, especially as we have become so domesticated and separated from them, mm-hmm. which is another reason why you should read Rascal.
Yeah, for sure. And they are, animals are companions of man mm-hmm. in many ways.
They are.
And especially dogs. Mm-hmm. And they have personality and
so much so.
So those dog stories are definitely really intriguing. And I wouldn't say that they're necessarily children's stories just because they've been marketed to children's stories, like you were kind of saying.
Right.
I think Jack London, again, is great for more late middle school, high school.
Yeah, he wasn't writing for kids either.
But oftentimes it's sold to children. And again, we have to qualify what we mean by children.
Right.
But the 13 plus crowd, 14 plus crowd, it can be really good for.
Yeah. And I would have no problem giving it to my Jack, who's 13. No problem at all. He'd be fine. Yeah. It would actually be a real stretch for him because the language is quite sophisticated, but it would be enjoyable. And the dog mm-hmm. violence is also part of the excitement. Like, it's part of what compels the story forward.
Mm-hmm.
So there you go, friends. Lots of Shakespeare and animal stories today. And a little bit of fantasy from Sarah.
Sarah and Tanya, been fun as usual. Thank you very much for giving us your afternoon.
It is always so much fun to come and see what everybody's talking about or what everybody's reading, because I last month could never have predicted that this is the conversation we'd be having this month.
No,
we never do predict. No.
I really hope that this is enjoyable for all of you listening as it is for us. And we would love to connect with you and hear about what you're reading. We also want to just remind you that you can find reviews or links to all the things we're talking about if you head over to the show notes. And if you'd like to connect with us, we'd love to find you on Instagram or Facebook, but we'd really love to find you in the BiblioGuides online community, which is a mighty network. And friends, like we said at the beginning of the episode, and we'll make a few more announcements about this as we go, but we're going to be changing our schedule just a little bit. And so we're recording this in March. In March and in April, we'll continue to produce about one show per week on Wednesdays. But then starting in May and June and July, we're going to take a little bit of break and we're going to do less recording, although we will continue to do this one so long as God lets us. And then in August, we'll be back in the spirit of back to school. We'll be back for four more months and then we'll take the holidays off. So friends, it's just a joy to have you here with us. We know your time is precious, and we are so grateful that you choose to spend some of it with us. Thanks so very much for listening, and until next time.